playing a tune that baby put on top, and it's a bat out of human skull. Come on, take a little walk with me, baby, and tell me who do you love.
I'm pushing my love, seems like my love wanna change.
Things, blues, and Southern Rock Podcast, a Southern Storm of bold, liberating rock, shot through with blues, soul, and gospel. And now, your hosts for the show, Brian Jones and Jason Johannes.
Welcome to another episode of the All Things Blues and Southern Rock Podcast. We are on Pantheon Podcast, where you can go to find your most preferred genre of music podcast. So head over to Pantheon now, and you'll find something that you like. With me always is Jason. Jason. I think Jason got abducted by aliens. He's probably on the mothership now, or he may have ran off to the Chicken Stand Ministry cult with Brother Tony Higbee from Tom Kiefer's band. But, you know, maybe he'll pop up and return again sometime here soon. So I'm flying solo this evening. So you got to bear with me, and hopefully you guys will keep listening to a show that Jason's not here for in the intro. Anyway, I want to talk about, give a big congratulations to our brothers, David and Ian from the State of America podcast, who recently, they celebrated their 100th episode, and their guest was Charlie Starr, our buddy from Blackberry Smoke. I listened to it. You guys should go listen to it too. It's just a really great chat, as it always is with Charlie. I got a update here. News, Robert John and the Wreck tour. They're ending their 2024 winter tour in the southern U.S. Wednesday, February 28th, Atlanta, Georgia, Smith's Old Bar. Thursday, the 29th, Asheville, North Carolina, at the Salvage Station. Friday, March 1st, at Chattanooga, Tennessee, at Songbirds. Saturday, March 2nd, at Maryville, Tennessee, at The Shed. And Sunday, March 3rd, Nashville, Tennessee, City Winery. Speaking of The Shed, my wife and I will be heading there in May to see all three Blackberry Smoke shows. And before that, March 15th in Medina Event Center, I believe it is. We're going to see Blackberry Smoke, and Them Dirty Roses will be opening. So that's going to be absolutely epic. So we're going to jump right into our guest. We have Robert Connolly Farr. He is a Mississippi Hill Country blues player. He is currently residing in Vancouver, but he is from Mississippi. It was such a thrill to talk to someone in that style of music again, that style of blues. It's been a while. I think Lightning Malcolm was the last guy that we talked to very early on in the podcast about this kind of blues. So it was very interesting to talk to Robert about how he got into it and his respect for some of those players and his description of that music and how he goes about doing it. So I'm going to quit talking here, and you guys kick back, relax, and listen to our conversation with Robert Connolly Farr. We're here at the guest segment of the podcast, and Jason is going to introduce the guest to you guys.
And as you know, I'm always excited to introduce the guest, particularly when we have a Mississippi-born, Auburn-trained, or Auburn-schooled architect who now lives in Canada that does blues music. So I hope I got all that right, Robert. Today with us, we've got Robert Connolly Farr. How you doing, man?
Doing good, doing good. How y'all doing?
We're good. We're real good. How's everything in Vancouver?
Oh, man, it's gray and it's wet.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, yeah.
You haven't picked up on a Canadian accent. Well, of course, Vancouver doesn't really have much of an accent out there. The West Canada doesn't.
Not one I can tell. I mean, I can hear accents, you know, like if I head back towards Alberta I hear it every once in a while up here. What I really hear up here is when I hear a Southern accent, I'm like, hey.
My friend, who are you? Where are you from?
Exactly. Where's the catfish?
How'd you end up in Vancouver from Mississippi?
Oh, man, it's I went west to L.A. and I took a right and I went as far as I could go. I did some nonprofit work out at Auburn University's Rural Studio after I graduated. And when finished up that project, the animal shelter out in Hale County, Alabama, I came to see a buddy of mine up at who was finishing a degree at University of Washington, and stayed up there for a few weeks. And while I was up there, I just took a road trip up here and just to pick up some Cuban cigars, man. And I was like, I didn't know there's a fucking city up here. Day one. I mean, you could go to the beach, you could go to the mountains. I mean, I'd never been anywhere like this before. And I mean, it was like a gut punch the minute I stepped foot in the city, and I knew this is where I wanted to be.
Right on, right on. How did you, you're like a Mississippi blues artist, Hill Country blues artist, but how'd you get to start in playing music?
Well, my mom bought me a guitar when I was, I think I was 15 or 16. It was right around the time Nirvana's Nevermind came out, because I remember learning like the riff for Smells Like Teen Spirit on this electric guitar. And then that was about it. I put it down. I didn't touch it for another few years until I was forced to. I needed some credits in college, and I was 19. I audited a classical guitar class. And I started learning how to play, you know, arpeggio style with my fingers on an acoustic guitar. And there was a fella that lived in Raymond, Mississippi. Ironically, it's where Kansas Joe McCoy's from, who wrote When the Levee Breaks with Memphis Minnie, that then Led Zeppelin turned into a big hit, right? But in that little town of Raymond, there was a fella, I guess you could call him a mentor of sorts, but I was kind of struggling, you know, with alcohol and drinking and whatnot, you know, like kind of younger college kids do. And this fella, he kind of taken me under his wing, try to be a good mentor. And he heard I was taking this class, and he handed me this Neil Young tablature book and a Decade album. And that was it. I was off to the races. I learned every song on that album. And Neil Young actually stole my heart. I mean, and his little riff with Lynyrd Skynyrd, you know, I thought that was really cool, you know, like, and I mean, I could still, you play one song on Decade, I could tell you what comes next. I mean, that album's just incredible.
How did that then, you know, phase into, you know, the kind of music you're playing now?
Well, you know, I just started learning all different kinds of stuff. I mean, like anything that I got into, I left school there and I went to, you know what, let me just do what this cat. he's not going to shut up. Hold on just a second.
We are a pet friendly podcast. Brian and my animals will make noise, and our guest animals are always welcome to make a noise.
Yeah, no, I got two Devon Rex cats. One's called Patterson and one's called Cooley. I'll buy the first one of you a beer if you name the two lead singers.
Drop by Truckers.
Go. But they're great cats, but one of them is very vocal. I started, you know, just learning songs and covering songs by people that I really dug at the time, you know, like Learning the Dead, you know, learning just anything that I liked. And I was into all different kinds of music, country, rock and roll, indie. Never Never while I was living in Mississippi was I into the blues, exposed to it, knew the fuck, like I didn't know shit about
really?
It. Really? Never.
How is that possible?
I don't know, but it happened. And I lived, I mean, I grew up at the four-way stop in Bolton, Mississippi, where Charlie Patton's from, where Sam Chapman's from, Walter Vincent, Bo Carter, like so many legends came from that town. And, you know, that's part of growing up in the South as a white kid. I just cut to the chase. You learn what they want you to learn. You don't learn the history of where you're from. You learn somebody's interpretation of that. So it wasn't until I got to Canada and I'd been up here a few years that people were starting to ask me about things. And, you know, I was still at the time I'd been up here 10 years in a Southern rock band playing kind of country roots blues music and under the moniker Mississippi Live and the Dirty Dirty. And I went home to see my dad one day and he has got some leukemia and we took a ride up into the Delta and big circle back around the home and went through Bentonia. And I wanted to show my dad this little juke joint that, you know, was in Bentonia that a friend of mine had told me about. I'd never even been in. And that day the door was open and Jimmy was inside and man, he played one song for me and my dad. And it literally changed my life.
I know you're talking about Jimmy Duck Holmes, you know, legend. So it's so awesome. It's so awesome.
Blows me away still to this day. And he, you know, he's a true gentleman. He's a true teacher, a mentor. I mean, and you know, it's seldom these days we talk about music. It's more about life, you know, and he's got such a beautiful, beautiful outlook on life. Such a real outlook, you know, like he's had to deal with some shit.
So were you just down there just a short time that time? So how much time did you get to spend with Jimmy? It was just like crash course stuff or were you there for longer?
Well, that was in 2017 and my dad he's got leukemia. He's been dealing with it for a while. And so I went home, I spent about a week at home that trip. And what happened the day I met him, which was just so serendipitous, and played music. I got him to sign my guitar and I went home and I was chatting with a buddy of mine, Alan Huffman. He's a writer, a journalist down in Mississippi, and he writes for different magazines when he's not working on books. And he was like, oh, man, I know him. I got to go interview him for a magazine for like Delta Airlines or something. And I was like, oh, man, well, I want to come with you. He's like, come and take some pictures and bring your guitar and let's see if he'll give you a lesson. And when Jimmy saw me show up with that guitar and he figured out that I played music, he was like, then we just started talking and I went back out there a few times and he was doing a show in Vancouver that summer. So he put me in touch with the guy that was booking him. And then I ended up picking him up from the airport and took him over to the show and, you know, hosted him while he's playing this little festival. And I mean, by the time he left Vancouver that summer, it felt like a good friend was leaving. And that's the way it's felt ever since then. And it blows my mind. Like he grew up, you know, 20 miles from where I grew up and I never knew him.
Was that the first time that you started playing that kind of hill country blues? And is it hard to put into words, like what you learned from Jimmy and what he gave to you?
Yeah, I mean, I try to because I want to honor it, and I think that it is important. He didn't have to teach me nothing. He saw me show up with that guitar, and he just started showing me things, and that was my first. You know, that was my. I tried to write a blues song a few years before, and I think I Googled YouTube like how to write a blues song. That was the truth of the matter. And then Jimmy, he plays this song for me and my dad one day and it floored me. It was must have been the devil. And, you know, I just wanted to learn to play his style. And he told me right away, he's like, you're not going to be able to play like me right away. He's like, it's going to take years, you know. And he was right. You know, I still can't play like him, but here I am 6-7 years in and I'm starting to just now do things that he was like, you just keep playing. It'll come.
Hello, Pantheon Podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house. And my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out. Because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
How did your Southern rock background help you transition to this style of music?
Well, I don't know if it helped. I think this style of music actually helped me to kind of more obscure the Southern rock aspect of what we were doing. Like, we turn the amps up and then we play a song and it's all on one chord, you know. And sometimes you hear Southern rock bands do that, like, you know, ZZ Top, that, you know, they had a lot of good hits like that. And what I've come to learn is that they were playing in Jimmy's tuning, they're playing in that open C minor, open D minor tuning a lot, you know. Sometimes they have more turnarounds and whatnot, but you know, the emphasis on the Bentonia style and what Jimmy's doing and a lot of that hill country is you just hang on that one chord, you know, hang on that one. Simpler is better, more obscure is better, you know, like more eerie, more like, what the fuck did we just do? That's it. You know, we want to grab onto that. So, you know, a lot of what Jimmy's been teaching me and kind of challenging me to do is to just kind of simplify what it is we're doing. You know, don't try to write a song. Let it come out. Don't try to add chords, try to take them away, you know. So it's been a really interesting experience.
So my hat's off to all, you know, the hill country blues players, because to me it takes a lot of discipline to stay on those one couple chords, you know, and just, you know, be passionate about that. A lot of people would be, I want more. I want to play more, you know, whatever. Yep. So you guys got to be some different kind of cats to, you know, like I said, just be disciplined and stay on that one chord. Can you speak on that?
Yeah, it is tricky sometimes. And it's something that I'm really grateful for my bandmates, in particular, Tom and Jay. Tom plays bass and Jay plays drums. They had a lot more experience with the blues before I came along, and they're two Canadian fellas, you know. And you know, Jay played with a alt country outfit up here called the Blue Shadows for a long time, and they were headed up by Billy Castle, who you might have heard of. And man, they were really great, just incredible country music coming out of this part of Canada right about the time of grunge hit in the Pacific Northwest. And so Jay's played with a ton of other bands, but you know, he's always been challenging me to kind of like, you know, why do we need a chord there? Why do we need a turnaround? Why don't we just stay on that? And at first it was like so awkward to me. It was, I'd even get kind of flustered and maybe a little irritated, and I'd just be like, why? You know, now it's just like, it's second nature. It's just like, oh, we don't need this here. We don't need that there. We don't need this here. You know, like, let's just straight through, you know. And we get, you know, people asking us all the time, like, there's no fourths or eighths or 12, there's no turnaround. Like, what's going on? You know? And I'm like, I don't know. We just playing it, you know? Like,
a lot of people are like much more aware of the Chicago style blues.
Yep.
And I think, you know, Mississippi Hill Country Blues is a little more underground, but it's like, it's almost kind of like, to me, has like almost like an outlaw kind of vibe to it. I mean, as far as being more underground, and it's a little more sacred. What's that feel like to you?
Sacred is a good word for it. You know, it's something that I love. So, you know, when I started studying architecture in Auburn, I studied a bit under kind of, not under, because the fella had died, but he died not long before I got there. And the school that I went to was still highly influenced by him, Sambo Mockby. He was an architect from Mississippi who taught at Auburn for a long time and started the Rural Studio. But his emphasis and other architects like fella out of Arkansas that just won the AIA gold medal a few years back. But they talk about the emphasis of the vernacular on their design processes, and the vernacular being, you know, not like a building that somebody paid an architect to design and build, but something that just, you know, like the lean-to that my papa put on the side of his house so he could have a wash house, you know. And sometimes, you know, you ride through my little town of Bolton and you see these shotgun houses, and you see houses with dog, you know, cabins with dog trots. And, you know, down south, you got the porch, and, you know, they paint the ceiling of the porches blue, and that keeps the wasps off and things like that. And it's just those, like, those subtle kind of vernacular inconsistencies that you see around that are just so beautiful and old. And like, it, to me, hanging on that one chord or that one note, or having that kind of, that rhythmic kind of drony kind of, you know, like a train going down the track that just can't stop, you know, it's just gonna go, you know, like, to me, it's eerie, and it is kind of spiritual. It is kind of, there's like a heartbeat. It's almost like a heartbeat or something, you know, like there's something to it. And so I think for, yeah, like, I think for me, I've been very, very inspired by that, and trying not to really mess with it, but try to just kind of dive into it, so to speak.
I wish I had, I got pen and paper, but I wish I had more, because I'm hearing all these cool, you know, Mississippi South, you know, words and whatever, just describe things. I mean, I know I'm going to go back and listen. I got to write this down. But just last night, I think it was last night, I was listening to an old Rig Rundown with Luther Dickinson from North Mississippi All-Stars. And
yeah,
he made a comment. He goes, yeah, I think Mississippi is it's its own planet.
I'd agree. I mean, that's, I mean, it's really cool. Like, you know, one of the things that we're so intrigued about in Mississippi by going down there is, you don't really know how things are going to play out. You know, it's like, you're going to go play a show at Jimmy's. Well, I don't know who's going to show up. I don't know if there's going to be a PA system. So, you know, they might be drunk. They might be sober. It might be raining, lightning, storm, tornadoes. I don't know, you know, but the music's going to happen. And what happens when the music happens is everybody comes together, black, white, yellow, red. I mean, it don't matter. Mm-hmm. Everybody comes together, and it's absolutely beautiful. And it's not what you see on the news. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that the problems that we see on the news don't exist down there. My experience down there is that music is the thing, the healing part of that brings people together. And I've witnessed that, you know, year in and year out, going out to Jimmy's, you know, and there's just something to be said for that, I think. And so, you know, what it's done for us is it's kind of freed us up here. Like with this last album we did, Pandora Sessions, we were like, well, let's not go into a studio. Let's just mic the amps in the studio space and just record it in there. Like, that's what we do in Jimmy's spot. We'd use a couple of amps and whatever mics we had, and that's the way we do it. And then, you know, we have 12 songs on that album, and I think there was a good 8 of them that I didn't write before we recorded. I was just like, Jay hit a lick, he hit a beat, and I started went in with a riff, and the song just came out. wasn't a lot of editing, but that's also something that we witness a lot in Bentonia, playing with Jimmy and the late RL Boyce. Is he just get up there, start playing, and a song would come out, and you're like, what the hell is this? I've never heard this before. It's like, me neither. You know, like it's amazing. It speaks to the vernacular. It speaks to the intuitive. It speaks to a music that's born of a spiritual kind of angst or yearning, I think.
Since you started playing this music, have you do you have any camaraderies or I don't know what word I'm trying to think of, a cool word, like other, you know, musicians from Mississippi that are playing this kind of music that you've gotten to be friends with or have camaraderie with, or your compadres, any compadres from the Mississippi Hill Country blues style?
Well, yeah. you know, just being able to go play at Jimmy's, you know, you get to meet anybody that comes through there. And I've gotten to see, you know, Cedric Burnside play, and man, he's just amazing. He played a set with Trent Ayers there one night, and the two of them, like Trenton's dad is a well-respected elder blues musician. And, RL Boyce would come down and play, and then I got to, you know, meet him a few times, and then he'd get me up on stage with him, and I'd be like, I can't hang with you, RL. And he's like, well, I'm going to show you how. Get up here, you know, and he wouldn't take no for an answer. You know, Terry Harmonica Beam, he's been up here to Vancouver to play with Jimmy, and, you know, same thing. He's like, get up here on the stage with us. And I'm like, I can't. I'm not there yet. And he's like, I don't care. This is how you get here. And so there's a lot of baptism by fire. And I think because of that, there is a camaraderie, you know, it's like anybody that you met, you probably done picked with a little bit, you know, and I really like that, you know. It's very uncomfortable, but once you do it a few times, it's like, that's how the show goes on, you know. That's how the show, because somebody's got to be playing music because other people are there to listen and drink. And if people are drinking, the bar's making money. And that's that, you know, it ain't about the money, but it's about the money.
I'm trying to think other North Mississippi Hill Country artists we've had head on, or people that play that kind of style of music. Early on, we had Lightning Malcolm, and I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked him. Like, everyone, I think, has their person that they, you know, look up to. Like, that guy was the renegade, that that guy's a badass, that guy's a renegade, whatever. But to me, I always love hearing about any legends about R.L. Burnside, because I think he's the man.
Oh, man. Like, he's so, like, I'm blown away. Both my drummer and I have been heavily inspired by him over the last year or two, you know, and just blown away, you know, blown away. I mean, that guy, oh my God, like, you know, but to watch Cedric play, I mean, like, and, you know, to know that Cedric recorded with him, you know, like that, I mean, I think, it's really cool to see the next generation of blues musicians starting to evolve, you know, and also with the nod back to the elders, you know, because nobody learns on their own. It's if it wasn't for, you know, people helping me out, like, where would I be? You know, I mean, I owe it all to Jimmy, because he just started teaching me. And I said, Jimmy, what do I do to pay you back? And he said, show somebody else. You know, if somebody wants to learn this style of the blues music, you offer to help them.
Was R.L. Cedric's dad, or was it grandfather?
I think it was his grandfather.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Well, yeah, I know, and I saw R.L. play twice. I saw him play twice, and I believe, like, Cedric was playing drums with him, and then Kenny Brown was playing guitar with those guys.
Yeah, that's another legend, Kenny Brown. Yeah.
So, is there a kind of scene in Vancouver for, you know, any kind of blues, or, you know, you said you were in a southern rock band there? What's that like, the music climate there in Vancouver?
It's interesting. You know, I've been here. This is my 17th year, and when I got here, there was a lot of kind of, like, you know, roots rock, country, country western, and But you know, it a lot of the music scene is contingent on venues as well. And so, you know, we've had like a bunch of venues that, you know, people played at for years and years and years, you know, they shut down, and the music scenes just kind of, you know, they kind of hem and haw. Like there are, you know, really great blues bands up here. You know, I don't really play with them, or, you know, I tend to stick with venues that I like more than anything. And there's a couple here in the hood that I really love. And so I usually end up playing shows. Like a few years back, we played the Rickshaw, and we had an opening spot for a couple of metal bands out of San Francisco and Seattle. Ironically, I mean, it actually sounded pretty good because all of our stuff's in an open tuning and it's distorted, and so, you know, you could see people like, what the fuck is this?
You know, you got a little heaviness to what you're doing.
There you go. Yeah. And so even live, it's, you know, it's even more. And so, you know, I think, so that's been interesting too, is like, you know, one, you know, in 19, I got a cancer diagnosis and I had a couple of surgeries since then. And so there's been the kind of health aspect that kind of took me out of being able to do a whole lot other than record, you know, which I was grateful to release a slew of albums over the last number of years. But what it's also done is it's put me in a position where I'm like, you know, I only want to play the shows I want to play. And I'm not going out and looking for a lot of shows to do because I have a lot of anxiety about playing live, and I'll get sick to my stomach, and I don't enjoy it that much because I'm just so fucking anxious. But I do think it's important to play live because of what I've learned from being back home with those elders, you know, not just because it's bigger than me, right? Like, there's a lot of people that get a lot of stuff out of a live show, you know, and as a student of Jimmy's and as an ambassador to my home in Mississippi, it's important that I do get out and play up here. So we've picked a couple of rooms that we like to play that feel really good and kind of cozy to us. And, you know, if we get a bigger shot from something like Live Nation or something, we'll definitely take it. And it's happened in the last few years, you know, every once in a while. But I think right now for us, it's like smaller shows really work on our craft. And so when the big shows call us, you know, we'll be ready.
Let's talk about your catalog a little bit, your record. So why don't you walk us through your albums and up to this last one, the Pandora Sessions, and kind of give us a little bit about what's going on.
Right on. Yeah. So the first album is just Mississippi Live. And it's we recorded that in 2009. And that was myself and another producer here in the city. And it was really the first time I'd ever done anything. And it was, I'd lay down something on acoustic guitar and sing, and then he'd put something over it. And, but it was also, you know, it got a couple of cool reviews right out the gate. And so, I put together a band to do a album release. And that ended up being our next record, which was Way Down Here, which was more of a kind of alt country Southern rock album, with a 4-piece band and, you know, all the turnarounds and the guitar solos and fun stuff. And we released Going Down after that, which was another kind of more kind of falling into that kind of Southern rock and alt country kind of vibe. And after that, I released a few EPs, you know, just kind of going through some stuff. And that was right about the time I met Jimmy, actually. And man, when I met Jimmy, it was crazy. It was like something about sitting down with him and learning. Like, I mean, it just opened the floodgates and all of these songs just started coming out and all these iterations of old blues songs started coming out. And so I booked some studio time in Alberta with a fella named Leroy Stagger. He's a Canadian songwriter and troubadour, is an all-around great guy, incredible producer. I went over to his place, and in one day we tracked the Dirty South Blues album, and he mixed it. I had a friend master it when we released it, and that was the one that took off. And like, it was, I pushed it for a year and, you know, thought it had gone as good as it was going to go. And then KEXP got a hold of it, and they started playing it. And then I got a Songwriter of the Year nomination for it, and things just kind of boom. It was like, okay, this is happening. And so, but then I got the cancer diagnosis, and during that, we recorded the Country Supper album, which was like a 2-album kind of deal. Lots of blues, Southern rock, country. Like, I mean, it's got every genre, you know, that I've ever played in it. And we recorded that in the same room that, the same studio that Aerosmith recorded their, Bruce Fairburn albums, and AC/DC was in that room. And like, I mean, it's just crazy, Motley Crue, you know, like Dr. Feelgood. Like, it's, I mean, I was just, all the shit I listened to when I was a kid, you know.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Room, you know, and, then I did an acoustic solo album after that called Ain't Enough, just to have it to pitch to Sync and TV and Film. And, then we did the Shake It album. And then early part of last year, we did a live album called Cherry Ball. And, and then we, after playing the Bentonia Blues Festival this year, my drummer and I came back and we just, you know, we mic'd the space and we did Pandora sessions over a few weekends of just jamming. And yeah, it's really like, oh, and there's a Live in East Van, which was initially recorded as a series of videos for an online blues show that happened at the start of the pandemic. And that actually has been a really great performing album for us, you know, another duo kind of heavy blues album. And so it's really just been about kind of following our gut and, you know, like, where are we at whatever given time, you know? And so but I think we like this idea of like working in our own little studio and seeing if we can, you know, really nail down the beds and the sounds, what we're looking for. We found in that more eerie, more obscure, more dirty, more kind of, you know, anything that doesn't sound normal is what works for us.
If, you know, our audience listening now, if they're not familiar with your music, where would you tell them this as a good starting point in your catalog?
Definitely head over to our YouTube page. we dropped a single off our Pandora Sessions album, 2 months ago. And like, we did a video for the first single, Getting Tired of Getting Old, and that thing's already got 90,000 views. And I've never had a video do that before. I mean, I have a video, really? My performing video before that was 5 years old and it had 20,000 views. So something's happening with this Pandora Sessions album that is, it's interesting because you release an album and you send it out to the journalists and the radio stations and you kind of judge it, you know? And so I haven't gotten that much response to the Pandora Sessions album as I have other albums. Having said that, it is a more unique sound experience because it wasn't in a big studio, but the fan response has been crazy. Like that's what I've noticed about this album. And there's just something more real about it for me. Like the songs were intuitive. They weren't written and, you know, and people dig that. Like there's something about it. So it's been very inspirational to my drummer and I, you know, to see that and see that actually happen, you know, after 16 years of working together, it's like, our best performing album to date, one we didn't do in a studio and we didn't write the songs for it. And they're all on one chord. And, you know, I mean, it's like, it goes back to that conversation about, you know, keep it simple, stupid, like, you know, simplifying things, like take that chord out of that song, take that chord out, you know, like there's something interesting about that.
Listening to you talk about, you know, recording these shows, it's very fascinating, but it sounds simple. I mean, is it really like you're just setting up mics and what is that getting recorded into? And is that like just the final copy right there? Or how's that all work? Yeah.
So like we'd have an amp. I got an old Harmony amp. I got another kind of nice amp that was made by a buddy of mine here in East Vancouver. That's what I sing through. It's got some reverb to it. Very simple, but really, really good sound. And, So we just tried to kind of separate our studio space up and then mic each amp. And then we had a mic on the two mics on the drums, I think, and a mic in the vocal amp and a mic in my guitar amp. And then that went into a little four channel mixer that the drummer had right beside his drum set. And so we just kind of turn everything on and he'd take a listen and, you know, see, yeah, we'd play a couple of seconds, you know, see if everything sounded like it was, you know, getting as good a sound as we could get out of there. And if you listen to that album, the songs are quite different, you know, sonically. And I was, to be honest with you, this album, I was probably the most like insecure about releasing. Having said that, I'm glad we did it. But still, you know, the sounds you can tell when you listen to it, but it's very honest. It's an honest reflection or like an honest kind of capture of those moments. And so we want to get better about that, you know, but I think for right now, like that's kind of how our process is. And like when we did the live album in January, Terry Ball here in Vancouver, same thing. Like he just mic'd everything and they ran it to the board and then they gave us the beds. So that was kind of even better than what we did with Pandora Sessions in a way. But yeah, like that's pretty much how that went.
Is that inspired by, or you know, is it somewhat inspired by, you know, the way the Elder Statesman, you know, the blues guys did, you know, like say, you know, another legend's Junior Kimbrough and his juke joint, you know, that burned down. Is that is how they would do it too?
Yeah, like, you know, I was really inspired by these videos seeing like R.L. Burnside, you know, playing in his front yard, you know, like sitting on a amp, you know. Right. You see the same thing with R.L. Boyce, you know. He'd have a drummer and he'd have a guitar sitting on an amp, and he had another amp right beside him, and, you know, he's singing and playing. And, you know, like, it's so simple and it's so effective. So we just decided, like, hey, let's see what we can do. And the thing was, we were getting some, like, there's some really interesting kind of sounds. And because I'm playing in that open C minor or D minor or F minor tuning, you get, like, that's a C, G, C, D sharp, G, C. So you got three C strings. And, like, what ZZ Top would do is they'd detune and uptune the bottom and the top one just a little bit, just so you get some really weird sounds when you play both of them together. You know what I mean? Like, and so you start to get these. So there's moments in that Pandora Sessions album and the Live in East Van, because it was recorded in a similar fashion, where I'm like, I don't know how we got that sound. Like, I don't know where that note came from. Like, that note I didn't play. That happened as a result of the way this thing was tuned and the distortion and all of that shit. Like, it's really cool to me.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. Those tunings, those open tunings. And once again, when I was watching that Rig Rundown with Luther Dickinson, like all his guitars were like tuned to like different open tunings and stuff. Like, yep. I would, do you know, Robert, do you know more about the history of how that came about? Like, is that something that came from Standard, or is Standard ever played in your style of music? Or, you know, it's just fascinating. What can you say about that?
Well, I know that Jimmy can play standard tuning just as good as he can play an open tuning, and that's really cool to me. Although I don't know much about the open G tuning that I think Kimbrough and Burnside might have played.
That's very popular, particularly in rock. Like, you know, you talk about the Stones, the Black Crows, they all do open G.
Yeah, yeah. So the thing that was really interesting to me about when I met Jimmy was he was in this open C minor tuning, and I got to talk, you know, talking a lot with his manager at the time, who was a kind of a Bentonia historian in a sense. And that tuning was different. That's why Skip James sounds so eerie, because he's playing a lot in those open in that kind of open minor tuning, as opposed to the open C the open G tuning. But my understanding from what Jimmy has told me and what I've read about the history of the Bentonia style was Jimmy learned from a fella named Henry Stuckey. Henry Stuckey was like the, he was like the OG Bentonia blues guy. And when he was young, he went to World War One somewhere. And when he was there, he met some guys, some soldiers from, I don't know if he was in Africa or if he met some soldiers from somewhere in Africa that were playing an open minor tuning on some of their instruments. And so he came home and he kind of was like, he liked that minor, that kind of really sad sound. And so he started playing in that tuning. Then he started teaching Skip James, and Skip started playing in that tuning. He also taught Jack Owens, who was Jimmy's kind of main mentor up until he died in the 80s. Jack was a big advocate for Jimmy to start playing. Like Jack, when Jack knew he was going to die, he was like, "Jimmy, you got to start playing. Like, you're the only one." So my understanding is that that tuning that makes the Bentonia sound so obscure kind of came from the original elder Henry Stuckey's travels during his experience as a soldier overseas. But I don't know like where that, it could have been like from the Caribbeans or something like that. So, yeah, it is a little bit different.
So I play bass, but I just started playing guitar. I played bass on an awful long time, but to start playing guitar and, you know, talking about this tuning, you know, I'm playing in standard, like how, like when you're playing that open tuning, that C minor, like how different is it? The chords you make, like, do you get used to playing chords on standard and then go to do that? Like, how does that evolve? How do you figure all that out?
Well, I mean, I don't really play chords anymore. Like that's the interesting thing about the Bentonia tuning, that open minor tuning for me is, it's so serendipitous that I started out taking that arpeggio class. And when I was 19 years old in college, they were teaching me to play with my fingers, and Jimmy plays with his fingers a lot on both hands too. Like if you watch Jimmy while he's playing, he's moving his right hand while, you know, he's strumming the strings and picking the strings. But if you look at his left hand where you might hold a G chord or something, his left hand is always moving. It's like a snake or something. It's so cool to watch him play. And I've shown a guitar teacher friend of mine out here, Paul Pagat, who's like one of the world's best rockabilly guitarists. And he'd be like, "It sounds like there's three guys playing right there." You know, so it's weird. Like there aren't any chord. Like there's, I think, one Bentonia chord I know, and it's kind of like a D, but it's in reverse or something, you know, but you always pick it, you know, and it, yeah. So, and my bass player, he asked what tuning we're in, and I think he just
plays in the scale or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Almost so, like being in a jam band.
It really is. It really is. In fact, so my bass player, he had a car wreck 2 years ago and he hasn't been able to play with us. And so we've kind of gone back to this duo thing, guitar and drums, which ironically is the way that, you know, Lightning Malcolm was playing with R.L. Boyce and a lot of these guys. It was just a guitar, Leo Bud Welch, you know, it was a guitar and a drummer, right? And so it's really challenged me to kind of, you know, up my picking style and my playing style. And so, like, somebody asked me a few months ago, like, "Who's playing bass on the Pandora sessions?" And I was like, "Nobody. There's no bass player. It's just me picking, you know." And so, but, you know, I couldn't do that right when Jimmy started teaching me. It's only now it's kind of come a second nature where I'm just kind of walking the bass line the whole time through the song in that kind of open, like, mm-hmm. C tuning. Well, it kind of feels bassy in a way, you know. It sounds like a bass guitar.
Well, if you're hitting one of those low open strings, it does give you, those are bass notes, you know.
Man. And like, that's the thing. It's like, you just, man, you want to do that as much as you can. Like, there's something there. It's something there.
So are you always like finger picking?
Yep. Okay. Yeah. I can't play with a pick, man. I'd hurt somebody with a pick.
Even when you're doing your Southern rock or like rock music, you're still all using your fingers?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And that's another thing too, is I've been so kind of into this kind of wormhole of the Bentonia style. Now I'm starting to revisit a lot of my old Southern rock songs as a kind of more obscure kind of blues song. And it's, you know, I mean, it's cool. It's there. It's workable. So it's been fun, but like, that's the thing, like the stuff that we were playing 2-3 years ago, like, we don't, I mean, even if we play it the same way, even if we play it live, it's not going to sound the same way because we sound totally different. Like, it's just constantly evolving.
It'd probably be interesting for you if you took some of those old songs like that and played them now in this style, like just, you know, even make a record or put a couple on a record.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, that's my my drummer and I were just talking about that the other day. It's like, we just need to pick 10 or 15 songs that we did, you know, decade ago and just see what happens, you know, like just try to revisit them, because you might have a whole nother record or two right there.
That's right. This
material is already written. Yeah.
It's one of the goals of this podcast to really hopefully get, you know, some people to see, you know, where Southern rock relates to the blues and comes from like the same genetics, so to speak. So it's interesting to like, talk about that.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, and it does. I mean, it's just when you look at like Skinner and ZZ Top and Allman Brothers, you know, I mean, all those guys were so heavily influenced by, you know, blues, you know.
Yep.
It's just, I mean, it's just always been right there. I mean, like, it just blows my mind.
So we forgot to mention we'd like to do the lightning round at the end, like some silly questions. Would you be up for that? And maybe yeah. maybe a little gear talk before we get into that. Jason, you want to do some guitar amp questions?
Yeah. Robert? So I'm interested. You know, Brian alluded to is watching Luther Dickinson's rig rundown. Like, give it like what's your rig look like right now from a guitar to amp?
It's so simple, man. Like, it's so simple. I use a 335. I run it through a tuner, and I run it through a Union tube and transistor. They're made here in Vancouver. You might have seen Stapleton playing one at the big football game there when he did the halftime show. Everybody was here up here was like, "Holy shit, he's using a Union pedal!" But some friends of ours make them here in town, and then my drummer. I guess about 10 years ago, he pulled this old Harmony amp that he had in storage. It was his brother's who recently passed away. And that's the only amp I use. I use an old Harmony amp from the 70s. You turn it all the way up, and you plug that Union pedal in, you turn it halfway up, and that's the sound right there off a 335. It's got to be a guitar with F-holes in it, though. Like, I can't play a Tele. If it's a jazz guitar, fuck that. I'm not playing it. Like,
big old arch top. No.
Yeah. So, I mean, but that's what I found over the last, I guess, 6-7 years is it's really hard for me to move from that Harmony amp, that Union tube and transistor. It's a Tone Druid is what it is. It's a gray pedal, and it's absolutely amazing. Like, just tone for days, man. Like, tone for days. It's I just want to get in it. And then that 335 is, and that's it. Like, that's the sound.
Tell us about your 330. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, go ahead. We got the same question. Is that like just a hollow body or semi-hollow?
Yeah,
Gibson?
Well, no, it's the Epiphone version. So I think it's a 339. That's what it is.
The 339's got a little bit of more of the smaller body than like the 335 that has the bigger body.
Okay, it's the Epiphone, and it is the bigger body. It's not the smaller body. So it is the bigger. It's like, and it's got two F-holes in it, and, you know, that's about all I know about it.
when I watched that rig rundown again with Luther, you know, he had all hollow body or semi hollow body guitars.
Got to put my headphones back on. All right. The Joe Bonamassa 62.
That's it.
Reissue. Yep. And it is, It's great. Like Epiphones make extremely good semi-hollow bodies, whether it's the classic Casino that's been around and the 335 version. These things are fantastic, and I could not recommend one more if you want a hollow body, a semi-hollow body.
100%, man. I'm not knocking the Casino, but I've tried it. I couldn't make it work. It's just that one 339, I think it is. It's got a Fireburst, you know, black and yellow, and I love it. I got another little backup guitar, which is a hollow body Tele with two humbuckers on it, but it just doesn't got the depth that Epiphone does. And another reason why I really love the Epiphone is because I figure if I was ever going to get a sponsorship out of one or the other, I'd probably get one out of Epiphone. So I'm always going to plug Epiphone. And Jimmy plays the Epiphone.
Nothing wrong with Epiphone. Again, semi-hollow body guitars are amazing. They've been played by artists for decades.
Yes. 100%. I love them. I love them. I can't say enough about them. In fact, I got a few of them.
Yeah, I'm not spending $4,000 on the Gibson 335.
No. I got two Gibsons, actually. In fact, a handful of the songs on Pandora Sessions, speaking of rig rundown, they are recorded on an acoustic guitar, and that's a 60.
I got a couple.
Yeah, I know. Looking back.
But they're Les Pauls. I got Les Paul Special and a Standard. So, but oh, I've got the Fenders up there too, a Tele and a Strat. So
there you go. Yeah. Well, the only other guitar I used on Pandora Sessions was a '68 Gibson B18, I think. So it was like their cheap kind of parlor guitar. Yeah. But I had a buddy put a pickup in it, and we ran that into that Harmony amp as well, no pedal, and just turned the amp all the way up. And it sounded really cool. I mean, it plays like a kind of semi, like a hollow body electric guitar. So, you know, but that was all we used on that record.
Yeah. And Brian, do you know why I have this model 335? No. Leilani talked me into getting it.
Oh, okay.
I was on the fence, and I am very glad she did. The one I have, Robert, is... it's a Joe Bonham. It's like it's a replica of his 62 he sold, but it's the Epiphone version. Has the Burst Bucker pickups, like actually Gibson America, but they're really nice. Has the trim bar on it, which I didn't think I'd like. I actually don't mind it, but it they just build a great guitar. They build a great guitar.
And I 100%. So hopefully they'll listen to this episode and maybe they'll sponsor both of them.
Well, a guest we had on the fall, Emily Wolf, who's I don't even know how to describe her music, is blues influence, but it's much more modern, out of Austin, Texas. She just came out with her second Epiphone. She's got a Black Wolf, then the White Wolf came out, and it's a version of the Casino, but it's got a smaller headstock, and it's a killer guitar. It's a killer guitar for like $800.
I'm gonna look that up.
Yeah, check out Emily Wolf, and Wolf she has an E at the end of her name.
Right on. Will do.
When you talk about, like you say, you can't play a Tele, you can't play these other guitars, it's just from the tone or the sound, or is the neck, you prefer the neck on the semi-hollow bodies, or?
It's the tone. It's the sound. Yeah. You know, like, I mean, I've had some beautiful Teles, and I just had to get rid of them because I couldn't use them. But I'm cool with it. You know, like it's good to know what works, because nothing more infuriating than having a nice guitar and not being able to get your sound out of it. And
yeah,
so that's been a lot of, like, I think the last kind of 10 years is just kind of learning a lot and honing at the same time, you know. But, you know, now I know that if I'm going to go play live somewhere, like I need a big fucking guitar with some airspace in it, two humbuckers. You know what I mean?
Like, well, it's the style you're playing that goes towards that, right? You're not going to be playing a Les Paul. You're not going to be playing a Strat, get the same sound.
Exactly.
Do you ever use acoustics?
Yeah. In fact, I do a lot of writing on acoustics. And so,
you showed me your guitar while I show you mine.
Please do.
This is my wall of guitars.
You do have a wall of guitars.
Yeah, and so it's just it's what I use to write with. I got a 12 string Gibson that I keep in an open C minor tuning. It sounds really wicked. Then I got the 68 Gibson, six string. I got a Les Paul electric, and then I got two acoustic guitars. And yeah, I keep them in all different kinds of, some's in open D, some's in open E, some's in open C, like there's one standard in there for a couple of years back. I got a Wild Hair Up My Ass and wrote a song in standard tuning for the first time in forever. And I think it's probably the best song I've ever written called Ain't Enough. And it just came out. I mean, the amount of time it takes you listen to the song, you listening to the first time I heard it, you know what I mean? Like some of the songs are just coming out nowadays. They just come out like, I literally, anytime I sit down to play, I hit record because something could come up and I don't remember well. I don't write shit down either. So I just hit that record and then I always got it. And, I keep a standard there because I want to brush up on those old country songs now and, just kind of, I've been thinking, it's been nice to do a lot of blues stuff, but I should probably revisit some standard tuning songs because I got so many of them.
Well, remember how to play a chord or a proper scale.
That's it.
Do I remember a pentatonic minor? Yeah, I think so.
That was one of the things that I really loved about meeting Jimmy, because right off the bat, he's like, I don't know much about guitars. I don't really know how to tune it, but I will play everything that I got for you, and it was like, and he will, and sometimes he plays and it's, and he's not even in tune, but it still sounds cool, only he could do that though. But it was inspirational to me because I don't know a whole lot about guitars or rigs, and I don't, I'm just not a very technical guy, but you give me an instrument and I can play a song. And I love that about Jimmy, because he will play for you if he's got an instrument, and that's a beautiful thing.
Love it. Brian, any more gear talk for Robert before we give him a couple crazy questions so he can get on his way?
No, I think I'm good. I think we're good.
All right. Let's jump into the lightning round. So we always ask our guests some silly questions. Okay. So if you're game, we'll jump into this.
Let's do it.
All right. What's one thing that you like about living in Canada versus the States?
Two Thanksgivings. Two turkey dinners.
They do. There's an October, don't they? One of them?
Yes, sir.
I work with some Canadians too. So, we always try to match up the holidays. There's a lot of holidays in Canada. A lot.
There really are. I'm always surprised. I'm like, oh, there's a holiday this month. I did not know that.
The hell, there's a holiday every week, it feels like.
I know.
You know what? Good on them. We work ourselves to death here, and they do it right. Europeans, man, they actually give you plenty of time off.
I know. I'm impressed with Canada.
Yeah, I mean, Vancouver, too, is a little bit like, it's an entertainment hub, it's on the West Coast, kind of like L.A. They film a lot of shows and movies out there, too.
Tons, yeah. And in fact, they were just filming right down the street when I was on my way home, and you never know. Like, it filmed so many great shows here.
Yeah, absolutely. Ketchup-flavored potato chips, where do you stand?
Man, seriously? Like, I don't get it, man. That's like pineapple on a pizza.
So you're anti ketchup flavored potato chips.
And the worst is when my wife brings home a bag of potato chips and it's ketchup potato chips and there ain't no other kind of potato chips and I'm forced to eat them.
It's just like a sweeter bar, like, our barbecue sauce. It's like the sweet version of barbecue chips.
I know, right?
You guys have like the all flavor or whatever chip too.
I know. I'll buy the all flavored chips way before I buy the ketchup chips. I was just so surprised. I moved to Canada. I'm like, oh, where are the mustard chips? Where are the mayonnaise chips?
Years back when I was in Canada, I remember my kids, I had to bring ketchup flavored chips back to them because they want to try. I think I got a tube of the Pringles and then a bag of like Lay's or something to bring back for them. You know, try to not smash while I'm traveling.
But chips
they're are all right.
Different countries. I mean, like they're just different. Like you go to Mexico and get those queso chips, man.
Oh yeah,
top dollar for that shit here. I will pay $10 a bag.
Japan has a beer flavored potato chip.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. In fact, there's a store just down the street from my house, and it's like an import store with all kinds of novelty drinks and chips and candies. And like you go down there, you get Faygos and anyway, they got
Kit Kat
section from all over the world, and they got those Japanese chips.
Kit Kats. There, Brian. There are you wouldn't believe how many flavor of Kit Kats there actually are in the world. Like so many.
Yeah.
What do you miss about the U.S. living in Canada?
Well, I miss catfish. I miss cornbread. I miss like the soul food that was just everywhere at home. You know, like I think that's the thing I miss the most. Like, you know, back home you could go get a catfish dinner, or you know, I knew where to go get good ribs, or you know, good barbecue, or. You know, back in the little town I grew up in, Bolton, Mississippi, there was a place called Max Cafe, and it was like a soul food kitchen. And yeah, I just don't see a lot of that up here. Having said that, you know, we got a lot of sushi. We got a lot of amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, in Vancouver, there's so many different ethnicities living in such close proximity. Man, I mean, it's just so many great different kind of foods. Ethiopian, Mediterranean, sushi, I mean, Indian, like a whole nine yards. It's like all within a few blocks. So
that's not Southern soul. That's all they're missing.
Yeah.
Maybe you get a side gig going. You can have a soul food place.
You know what? I'm seriously thinking about it. Like,
I would try it out when I was up there. Let's see what Canadian soul food's all about.
Yeah, there you go.
All right. If you could choose any bill that you wanted to be on for a night, like play with any artist, who are you choosing?
Like current artist?
Anybody. From history to now.
From history to now?
Anybody, yep.
Living or dead?
Living or dead? You know, I mean, to be honest, it'd have to be, you know, like Junior Kimbrough or Burnside or Leo Bud Welch. I mean, like, you know, I'd just want to soak up whatever I could, you know, from them, you know, like, give me somebody obscure that, you know, like, I think that, you know, I saw Leo Bud Welch the year before he passed away. And I remember he was at the Bentonia Blues Festival and I had to leave. And I remember seeing him sitting under a tent with an oxygen machine and thinking like, fuck, it is so hot out here. It is so hot. And he was just about to go play. And I heard like one song and I had to leave. And I always kick myself because he became such a huge inspiration for me. And I'd have loved to spend some time with that man.
That's a good choice.
Yeah.
What's your dream venue to play?
The Blue Front Cafe, buddy.
There you go.
I love it, man. Like big venues, it might be fun, but I don't know. There's something about these old juke joints back home where, I mean, anything goes, man. Like, if you ever get a chance to go to the Bentonia Blues Festival and spend a few days in Jimmy's juke joint, I mean, it's a life-changing experience.
Brian, we have to figure out a trip where we can go down, visit our friend David Hudson from the State of America podcast and go through some Mississippi haunts with them.
Yeah. Another trip to the Delta.
He'd probably make us ride a bike through everything because he's on this big mountain bike gig.
Oh, man.
We might have to come in agreement that we're driving everywhere, not riding bikes.
If y'all go back down there, y'all holler at me because I might be down there and I'd love to show you around, you know. But
yeah, I know, absolutely. That would actually be fantastic if we could figure that out.
Yeah. So.
What are the last three artists that you've streamed or listened to?
It would be that Mexican OT. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he is a rap. He's a Mexican rapper, Mexican Houston rapper. He's out of Houston. Fuck, he dropped a single a week or so ago, and he's just it's this.
So you're into Mexican rap music? Okay. I would not expect that. That's a good one.
Well, it's like I'm into anything Southern, man. Like Southern rap. Oh, I love Southern rap. Like anything out of Memphis, New Orleans, Atlanta, you know, back home, you know. And anyway, this guy, I ran across him on YouTube, and he's like, it's like Nacho Libre meets like Young Dolph it's crazy. It's so good. So it was him, and I was just streaming some Jessie Mae Hill. I love her. And who was the other person that I was just streaming? Oh yeah, Charlie Crockett. He's dropping a new album, and I really love Charlie Crockett. What a phenomenal songwriter. Just a prolific creator as well. So, and the Sleaford Mods. I've really been inspired by their video work. There are a couple of Scottish guys
they sound Scottish with that kind of name.
Yeah, they are really good, man. Check them out. It's like,
would you say the Sleaford Mods?
Sleaford Mods, SLEAFORDMODS. Yeah, they're really cool.
Like the Mods, that was that old like 60s style in the UK. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, it's good. It's good. Yeah.
Okay. Sleaford Mods. All right, I'm going to check them out. And Brian, our friend Tony Higby, we exchange weird bands. I might have to send this over to him.
Yeah.
So Tony, if you're listening, we're sending you the Sleaford Mobs your way. last question. Give us or tell us a story of an interesting thing that happened to you when you're playing live. Funny, like what if you had to tell somebody a great story about performing live or being on the road, what would you tell us?
Oh man, let's see. I think one of the funniest things that happened to me was early on when I started performing as a songwriter was when I was doing that nonprofit work in like kind of 2008, 2007. And it was in the middle of nowhere, Alabama. And there was a Mexican restaurant that would let me play for a few hours on Thursday night, and they'd give me $40 and a free meal, which I needed, right?
Like, yeah,
I
wasn't, yeah.
You know, and I'd go and I'd set up in their little bar and I'd play. And I remember one night there was this table, couple of ladies sitting across the room from me. And one of them just was not into what I was playing. And so she just pulled her cell phone out and she just started playing a song really loud on her cell phone. And I was just like, oh, no, you know, and oh. I was probably playing some, I don't know, Willie Nelson or I don't know, you know, something. And anyway, I finished the song I was playing and I took a little break and I walked by her table and I was like, I got a song for you. And I played her, I Will Survive, and not the cake version.
I was going to say Gloria getting her cake or whatever you got. Yeah,
exactly. She was blown away, man. Like it was, you know, but that's, you know, It just speaks to that connection that happens through music, man, you know, and it is so easy to get offended these days, but it's also so easy to just, you know, shoot out some love instead of, you know, I'm bad. You ask my wife, I'm bad about being an asshole. I mean, so it's like, if I can,
they kick you out of Canada for that, don't they? That's my one complaint about Canadians is they're just so nice and polite all the time.
They really, you know, I tell you, I can't speak enough about Canadians. I mean, it's just there's always assholes. I mean, you know, it's my papa, he used to say you can't do nothing with people. And I mean, you look at the state of the world right now, it's like any country is struggling with the same thing that everybody else is struggling with, you know. So
there's not a lot of assholes, but they're the most vocal and get the most amount of attention.
There you go.
I do have one question. I lied. So you're an Auburn grad.
Yep.
I was Alabama. Born. So University of Alabama. Are we going to win the Iron Bowl now with Saban gone? Like, and everybody transferring?
I just don't know. I mean, you know, that's the thing, like with Auburn and Alabama, it didn't matter how good either team was when those two teams met. I mean, it was a brawl. It was
a close game this year, man. Really close.
Totally.
Auburn
right?
was leading in third quarter. Yeah.
There you go. You know, it's like, and that's what, but you know, Alabama's consistently good and they got a lot of good players and they know their game, you know, like I don't know. I'd be interested to see what happens with them, but you know, and you know, I don't have no heart. I mean, good for Nick Saban, you know, whatever he wants to do, but I'm kind of tired of seeing Alabama win all the time. You know what I mean? Like, come on.
I think there are a lot of people who express that same sentiment. I'm pulling for Auburn in the Iron Bowl. Absolutely. Always do.
There you go. Yeah.
All right, Robert, where do we send our listeners to go to find more about your music, listen to your music, where you're playing?
Check us out at Bandcamp and check us out at YouTube, Robert Conley Farr. Can't miss it. We're everywhere else, though, Spotify and all that kind of stuff. But check us out in those two locations, Bandcamp and YouTube.
And you have a webpage as well, correct?
Yeah, I don't keep it updated that much, but it's just robertconleyfarr.com.
Okay, very good. Well, it was great having you on. Over to you, Brian.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much to Robert Conley Farr for joining us, man. It's been a pleasure. I'm always fascinated hearing about that music, North Mississippi Hill Country music, and just thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been an honor to be on the show, fellas.
Thank you to Robert Conley Farr for joining us, being our guest. What a pleasure. We certainly enjoyed listening to Robert talk about, you know, getting taken under the wing of Jimmy Duck Holmes there at the Blues Front Cafe. I can't imagine how thrilling that must be. And that's definitely a destination that we are going to have to don the doors of. You could tell how incredibly grateful Robert was to have had that experience and to, you know, learn under such an amazing, amazing guitar player in this style of music. Great to hear about the old greats too, you know, R.L. Burnside, Junior Kimbrough. Great to hear a little bit about, you know, we mentioned, talk a little bit about Luther Dickinson and the North Mississippi All-Stars. So that's always cool to hear about that. And what a great pleasure to talk to another guitar player in this style of music, the North Mississippi Hill Country Blues. We definitely plan on having some more folks from that style of music. We certainly hope to talk to Jimmy Duck Holmes at some point. So until that happens, always remember, Southern rock is reverent, blues is blood. We'll see you next time.
Baby, go down south, I'm gonna take you home. It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.